Morning, everybody. Thank you for coming to our last session before the closing this afternoon. I'm Bob Vollinger. I'm a program director in the Tobacco Control Research Branch at the National Cancer Institute. Been doing that stuff for a long time, working mainly with state and community policy interventions there. And I'm also a doctoral candidate in public health at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and working on a project on smoke-free multi-unit housing. And so was honored to be asked to moderate this panel today. I think this is a really important topic, and by virtue of the fact that you're here, I'm going to guess that you do too, at least to some degree. The name of the panel of the session today is Smoke-Free Begins at Home, Partners and Pitfalls in Multi-Unit Housing. And so for any of you who've worked on the topic of secondhand smoke interventions, many of you know that we've passed policies in public places, restaurants, workplaces, bars, and so now almost half of the population is covered by laws that prohibit people from smoking indoors. And one of the consequences of that is that the next frontier has become smoke-free policies in homes, because that's the place where increasingly more and more people are getting a greater proportion of their exposure at home. And so the whole topic of dealing with interventions in homes, and particularly multi-unit housing, is increasingly important. So we're honored today to have a great panel to talk to you about this topic from several different perspectives. I'll just mention who our speakers are at the beginning, and then they'll just go through their presentations in sequence. So first we have Warren Ortland, who is a staff attorney with the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium. I'm also a part of the Public Health Law Center at the University of Minnesota's Law School. And Warren has been doing this work for quite a while, so many of you who have been tracking it are familiar with him and may have even heard him speak on the topic before, and he's going to give kind of a highlight of some of the important topics in the whole issue. And then next we have Ann Dozier. Dr. Dozier is an associate professor and the interim chair in the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Rochester. Unfortunately, she got out of Rochester before they were overtaken by the... No, I know, it's not quite as bad as Buffalo, right? Everybody's seen that Buffalo is under 4 to 6 feet of snow. But anyway, so she's going to be talking about the work that she's doing there on this topic. And then finally, Susan Berquist. And Susan is a tobacco prevention coordinator and the lead for the multi-unit housing project they have in the Maricopa County Department of Public Health. Maricopa County, you may know, is Phoenix, and they have been doing a lot of work on this topic for a while. I was at another meeting back in May, and there were some of her colleagues were there talking about their work, and so we'll be glad to hear what Susan's going to be saying from the local level as well. So I think we've got a great panel, and they'll each speak for about 20 minutes, and so at the end we'll have plenty of time for discussion and questions from you, and I'm sure that you'll be glad to participate in it when we get to that point. So thanks very much. Warren?
Okay, thanks. Okay, the smoke-free housing movement has kind of matured. I started in 2007 working on it, and at that point we have very few apartment buildings in Minnesota that adopted smoke-free policies, and we knew of only a handful of public housing authorities that had done so. Now we know of probably over 300 housing authorities around the country that have adopted smoke-free policies, and I know we have over 1,000 market rate properties in Minnesota that have adopted smoke-free policies. So as it's gotten more mature and more accepted, now we're starting to see kind of the second level of questions come up, new issues that are coming up. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the new issues. The other thing that's coming up is most of the work so far has been done by adopting private policies. So individual apartment buildings will do it on a voluntary basis. But now we're seeing some communities looking for public policy approaches, where it might be incenting or requiring properties to go smoke-free. So I'll talk a little bit about a couple of public policy options. First, the disclosure, and I have no relationships to disclose. A little bit about my organization. Again, I work for the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium, and we're a national resource on all kinds of tobacco control policies. So we'll help state government, local government units, private attorneys, individual citizens, on any questions they may have about tobacco control. So at the end of the presentation, I will provide you my contact information. And so if you do have questions in any area, feel free to give us a call. All our services are provided for free. We are supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. One of the new topics that is coming up in a lot of communities is medical marijuana, and now we have also recreational marijuana. Minnesota just adopted a medical marijuana law. It's a little more restrictive than some of the other states. I think there are around 20 states now that have medical marijuana and the District of Columbia. Also, we're seeing some states now adopt recreational marijuana laws. I think in the last legislative session, Alaska and Oregon adopted it, and that goes along with Washington State and Colorado, and also the District of Columbia. So we're getting questions whenever I speak around the country about how property owners should be treating the use of marijuana in their properties. And there's a little bit of difference between whether it's a market rate property or whether it's property that's subsidized by HUD. First, I'll go into a little background on HUD's approach to how they treat medical marijuana. They've come out with a series of memos over the last few years, starting in 1999. Starting around the same time as some of the states started passing medical marijuana laws. And they were getting questions from Section 8 properties, public housing, on how they should address requests from residents who may have conditions that are considered a disability, and then they have gotten approval from their state government to use medical marijuana. These public housing authorities were wondering, well, can they restrict its use? Because they may not want to have it on the property, or do they have to provide the ability to use it as a reasonable accommodation? So HUD came out with these series of memos, and they were updated the last time in 2011. And so on the next page is a summary of the provisions and the guidelines that HUD is providing. First off, marijuana and medical marijuana still remain a federally controlled substance. So property owners do not have to permit its use on their property. Also, federal law trumps state law. And so anytime there's a state law, even if right now the federal government and Department of Justice is seeming to take a hands-off approach, that can change, and then the federal government can come in and enforce the federal policies or the federal laws. So there was always a risk that a property owner who was allowing the use of medical marijuana or recreational marijuana on their property, that they could face some federal penalties. So HUD just wanted to remind all property owners of that. One of the things, they have a list of kind of three parameters that they require of the housing they support. First, if an applicant is a known user of medical marijuana, they cannot be admitted to the property as a resident. Second, if an individual has a condition that's considered a disability and they request a reasonable accommodation to allow them to use medical marijuana, it has to be denied. But they allow for some compassionate individual determination by the property owners. If a current resident is a known user of medical marijuana, perhaps they develop a condition that then is considered under state law one that can be ameliorated with the use of medical marijuana, they have discretion on how to proceed with that individual resident. So they can choose to proceed with eviction, or they can allow the resident to remain in the property. Now that seems a little bit contradictory to the no reasonable accommodation provision. And what HUD is saying in their memo is they don't want to set an example or a precedent through the use of a reasonable accommodation that then they would have to apply to all subsequent similar requests. So they don't want to have to be granting accommodations for anyone who has cancer or HIV and AIDS or other conditions that are considered eligible for the use of medical marijuana. They want the determination to be very individualized and on a case-by-case basis. So the public housing authority or the Section 8 property owner can allow the individual to stay, but it's based on their determination, and it's, again, a case-by-case basis. So it's not something that then would necessarily be repeated when the next resident asks for a reasonable accommodation. As far as private property owners, they are not subject to these regulations. So they can allow residents to continue to reside in their property and use medical marijuana, but they don't have to, because again, similar to the federal property, they could be subject to federal penalties if they're allowing its use on their property. And as far as the reasons to or help decision making as far as the use of medical marijuana, there are a lot of the same risks that are posed by exposure to secondhand smoke, they could also be exposed. These conditions could also exist with the use of medical marijuana. We don't know as much about the secondhand smoke that's produced by the use of medical marijuana as we do with traditional cigarettes, because the federal government had severe restrictions on research around the use of marijuana. So marijuana can cause fires. I mean, a joint can set a unit on fire just like a cigarette. Again, there's the potential health risks from exposure to secondhand smoke. And there's also the concern over role modeling or exposing youth to the use of medical marijuana. So for all of these reasons, you know, private property owners can restrict its use on their property. They also are concerned, well, will I get a request for a reasonable accommodation? And in private property, how would I treat that? Well, there's a provision in our disability statute that's saying the accommodation that you grant cannot be a violation of law. So in other words, a property owner or others, an employer, can't be required to grant an accommodation that would violate federal or state law. And since the use of marijuana is still federally prohibited, therefore an accommodation does not have to be granted by private property owners. So they do have flexibility. Since the federal government is not strongly enforcing the federal laws where it's legally permitted at the state level, but they can choose to do whatever they want, but you know, we kind of urge them to maybe treat them just the same way they do the smoking of cigarettes. The other topic we're seeing everywhere is the use of electronic cigarettes. And property owners ask us, well, how should I proceed with this? I mean, they're hearing anecdotal evidence that electronic cigarettes may provide some cessation support for individuals who were smokers. So they're concerned that they might be required to allow its use on the property. Well, first off, some of the considerations about e-cigarettes is they're currently not regulated by the FDA. The FDA came out with what's called a deeming regulation, a proposed regulation that would allow them to control or regulate electronic cigarettes, but that is just in the comment period, and we don't know how long that comment period would be, but it'll probably be several years. So at this point, electronic cigarettes are not being regulated at all. And they are primarily, or a large majority of them, are manufactured outside the country. So we know very little about the control that's involved. Also, we know very little about what the chemicals might be in the liquid, what's called e-juice. We don't know what chemicals might be in there. We know there's probably, we definitely know there's nicotine, but we don't know what level the nicotine might be at. It varies, and it can be customized by individuals who go to some of these e-juice parlors. So that can be customized. We know there's propylene glycol. That produces the vapor that comes out. But we don't know all of the effects of what might be produced by propylene glycol when it is vaporized. It is approved for some uses in food production, but we don't know enough about it when it's heated to the point of vaporization. But we don't know all the other chemicals that might be involved. A lot of these customized e-cigarette parlors have a wide variety of different flavors that you can add to the product. And fortunately, a lot of them are very attractive to youth. They have bubblegum, cherry, chocolate, and vanilla. So we don't know a lot about what these chemicals might do when they're vaporized as well. So for that reason, when we're talking to property owners, we say it's probably a good idea to be better safe than sorry, so you may want to consider restricting it. Also, for properties that may already have a smoke-free policy, allowing the use of electronic cigarettes may pose some enforcement challenges. Because if you look back at this picture, some varieties of electronic cigarettes look almost identical to traditional cigarettes. Even this one has a simulated ember on the end, a little orange light that'll light up when the individual inhales on the product. So individuals responsible for enforcing a smoke-free policy on the property may be confused whether they have to tell the individuals to stop smoking their traditional cigarette or whether it's something that could be permitted. So for that reason, we also think that it might be a good idea to include the use of electronic cigarettes in their smoke-free policy. Also, getting back to role modeling, we're getting to the stage now where the smoking of cigarettes is seen as somewhat an unacceptable activity, or at least more of a fringe activity, and we don't want to see the use of electronic cigarettes starting to renormalize the activity of smoking. So that's another reason to consider prohibiting its use. The other thing we're seeing now is a dramatic increase in calls to poisoning centers from the consumption of the e-juice. So as I said, we don't know all the chemicals that are in there, but we do know there's nicotine in there. And nicotine is poisonous, and we don't know the levels that are contained in the e-juice. So there, in a lot of cases, have been very high levels of e-juice, and individuals, children primarily, who get hold of these cartridges with these very appealing variety of flavors and then consume it, they're getting poisoning responses. So we're seeing a large increase in the calls to the poisoning center in Minnesota and around the country. So property owners may want to prohibit their use so that the cartridges are not disposed of in the property's garbage, and then that provides easy access to youth. So for all of these reasons, we urge property owners to consider including the use of electronic cigarettes in their smoke-free policy. This is an example. The language to modify a current lease to include the use of electronic cigarettes can be very simple. So you want to maybe change, if there's a definition of smoking in the policy, just add language at the end that definition includes the use of an electronic cigarette. And then the definition for what an electronic cigarette is can be fairly simple. We're seeing a wide variety of how different jurisdictions define the product. Some call it electronic nicotine delivery systems, electronic inhaling systems. So I think we haven't determined what's going to become generally accepted as a term, nor have we determined what's going to be generally accepted as a legal definition, because we haven't seen any cases come up where these definitions have been challenged. But it can be, for the current, you know, for the time being, be something very similar and generally understood. And we think most courts would recognize this as, you know, what a normal person would expect an e-cigarette to be. So it can be a fairly simple modification to an individual's lease to prohibit its use on the property. The next thing I wanted to talk about was disclosure. These are a couple of public policy approaches. So when you are getting to the point where your voluntary adoption in your market or your jurisdiction may be coming, slowing down because a lot of properties have already adopted smoke-free policies, you can consider some public policy approaches. One that we think is very attractive and has been adopted in several areas is a disclosure ordinance. And what the disclosure ordinance requires is that property owners or condominium sellers just disclose to potential renters or potential buyers what the policy is for the property. They don't have to mandate a policy. They just have to inform prospective consumers or renters that they may be facing exposure to secondhand smoke in the future. Because we get a lot of questions, a lot of calls come in from individuals who have just moved into their apartments, and they said, I inspected the unit, I walked around the property, did not see anyone smoking, didn't think to ask the question, and then a month later someone moves in below them or next door and is smoking heavily. So there's not a lot you can do in that instance, because you may be in the first month of a year-long lease, and if the property owner doesn't choose to accommodate you, then you may have to stay there or pay the penalty for breach of lease. There are several jurisdictions that have adopted this already. Oakland, California has adopted it. The states of Maine and Oregon have adopted it at the state level. The city of Duluth, Minnesota has also adopted it. So we're seeing it become more popular because it's not a mandate, it's more of an incentive. This is kind of an appealing option for legislatures or city councils because it isn't a mandate. They don't see it as much of an infringement. It's just something like the warning labels on the side of cereal or other products saying this was packaged in facilities that use peanuts or other nut products. It's just putting people on notice. Let's see. This is some of the language. This came from Maine, and this is as simple as the language can be, just requiring a disclosure of what the property policy is before the person rents. One of the things is a lot of these ordinances, because they are fairly new, they don't have very strong enforcement provisions. So if a property owner does not disclose, Right now, we're not seeing, you know, penalties or allowing an individual out of the lease if they then subsequently become exposed and they weren't told about it. So we're working on trying to get some of the enforcement provisions to be stronger. So right now, the ones, especially at the state level that you'll see, generally just have the language. It's more of an encouragement and not something that has a lot of teeth to it. Some of the benefits of the disclosure option is it is broad-based. So it would apply across the jurisdiction, across the county, or across the city. So it could serve the purpose of also informing the property owners that this is an option that they can choose. We saw this in California, in Oakland, where they went with the disclosure, and then the lung association there was getting a lot of calls saying, well, I didn't know I could go smoke-free. So this helps to serve an education purpose. It helps to educate both residents as well as landlords. It's not a mandate, so that makes it appealing to some politicians. It may have housing association support. So in a lot of cities, there's a multi-housing association, and we've seen some of them become supporters of this policy because they're concerned about property owners may become sued if they don't disclose what the policy is. And then as it becomes more generally accepted that exposure to secondhand smoke is dangerous, property owners may be expected in the future to disclose this. So right now it's not something that's mandated, but I think a lot of the communities are starting to do some of this action in advance. Some of the challenges or weaknesses in a disclosure policy is it may not result in any smoke-free policies. It just may, the status quo may remain the same except for the disclosure. It may not result in the adoption of additional policies. So far, we've found it hard to assess the effectiveness of this, whether it really does result in more people being protected or in policies being adopted. And enforcement, as I said, can be an issue because the policies or the laws that have been passed so far don't have a lot of teeth to them. Another option that, again, is more of an incentive is the low-income housing tax credit program. This is a currently existing federal program that provides tax credits to all the states, and it's used to motivate communities to build low-income housing. But the communities and the states have the option of defining what they want those properties to look like. So it's a competition for the credits, and so communities can say, well, we want our low-income properties to be near rapid transit. We now want them in specific neighborhoods. We want the property to have internet service throughout. So they can set up these criteria, and then the community gives points in the competition for properties that adhere to these criteria. And so what some communities have done is they say, we'll give you an extra point in this competition if this property opens up smoke-free. So California now has this at the state level. Minnesota has it at the state level. Maine has it at the state level. So these, we're seeing some effect of it now where a lot of the applications that are coming in do have this point designation for smoke-free policies. So again, this one is not a mandate, it is incentive. So I think this one can also be appealing. It takes very little to change it because the criteria are already listed. This is an example from Louisiana. This is Louisiana's housing agency that would handle the low-income housing tax credit program. And you can see here one of the criteria or a list of their criteria in their program are some project characteristics. They have green buildings, community facilities, optional amenities. So this is where a smoke-free policy might be listed. It would be listed with these other elements that they're hoping to encourage people to adopt. And so this one is another approach that we'd like to make people aware of since it's something that's currently available and fairly easy to convince the community to adopt. This is just some information on our resources. Again, I work with the Public Health Law Center. This is a copy of our website, and we have a lot more housing resources on the website. We do have a series of publications. Some of these are at our booth if you happen to stop by during the session. We also have them available electronically, so you can go here and download them. And this is our contact information. Maggie Mahoney is the deputy director of the consortium, so she would be your primary initial contact. But if it's housing questions, they generally always come to me. So you can also contact me directly, and then I'll let Maggie know that I got a question. So that's it on my presentation.